And I'd like to welcome everyone to another Weber Training teleconference. It gives me great pleasure to present Dr. Lindsay Hulster, who's going to be speaking to us for the next 45-50 minutes or so. Dr. C. Hulster is no stranger to the Weber teleclass. I looked in the recording library online there, and her name pops up at least 7 times as I flipped back through the years. And I like to see that Paul Weber gets Dr. C. Hulster in at least twice a year to do presentations for us. Dr. C. Hulster is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia, and she's been there for 14 years, working in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion within the National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. Prior to that, she had worked as an infectious disease epidemiologist for 15 years at the Texas Department of Health. Her current areas of expertise focus on environmental infection control, microbial inactivation, and transmission of infectious diseases. She's an advisor for not only the CDC, but for healthcare professionals and the public on issues concerning environmental cleaning, sterilization, disinfection, prion disease, and environmental management of emerging diseases. I could go on and on and on, but to give a full bio here, she wouldn't have any time to do her presentation. So I'd like to introduce Dr. C. Hulster, speaking on recovery from floods, basic principles and practices for mold control and structural remediation.
Well, thank you so much, Jim, and welcome to all our attendees today. It is my pleasure to be part of this teleclass lecture series for 2011. And today what I decided to do was to give the infection prevention community an overview of methods, strategies, things to consider when it comes time to dealing with water intrusion problems and mold occurrence and mold removal from the built environment. Now, on the, the second slide, which is my disclaimer statement, which we're required to do as part of being in the federal government here in the U.S., this lets you know that I have no outside interest. And basically what I'm saying here today is pretty much the knowledge and opinions of myself and the resources that I have used to prepare the lecture material. In the third slide, you'll note it's just a very, very Spartan slide with a question, why are we here? Now, I do have to preface the lecture today to let you know that that I had given this presentation at the American Society for Healthcare Environmental Services, their main conference back in September. So the question, why we are here, refers to why that group was in the particular hotel where the conference was held. And the reason was, as you will see in slide 4, is because of what you see in those pictures. Originally, that ASHES conference was scheduled for still in September, but in the Gaylord Opryland Hotel there in Nashville, Tennessee. And you may have recalled news stories that talked about the tremendous amount of rain that the area had, and they're on the Cumberland River there in Tennessee. So lots of rain on a riverbank, and you see the effect of that that combination. There were areas of the hotel that were 10 feet underwater, and in some of the atria in the hotel, many of the umbrellas and other equipment and furniture were completely underwater. It was literally a mess. And what can we say? It's not unique to hotels. If you see in slide 5, this was just one of a few pictures I have in this presentation today of one of the hospitals that was in the Mississippi Gulf Coast area when Hurricane Katrina and then later Hurricane Rita struck the Gulf Coast of the United States back in 2005. So the built environment, whether it's hotels, hospitals, office buildings, schools, residences, if you are in an area where there is a body of water nearby, you have an excellent chance of having flooding at some point in time. And in slide number 6, I've given at least a little rundown of some of the recent floods that have happened in the U.S. in the last 10, 15 years. And you'll notice, again, all of those areas are near bodies of water, whether they are major rivers, the ocean, the Gulf, lakes, etc. Pretty much weather-dependent. There's a number of factors relating to flooding. And certainly, as you can see, in 2011, I say anticipated because we're not having them yet, but the same type of flooding that was experienced in 1997 in Grand Forks, North Dakota, is probably anticipated for the upper Midwest section of the U.S. as the snows from this winter have started to melt. They will basically follow the law of gravity, flow down through the river valleys, and since we have had an incredible amount of snowfall, we are anticipating flooding. Matter of fact, in the Minnesota area where Minneapolis and St. Paul are located, they've just recently had another bout of snow, and they're anticipating that there's going to be flooding in that area of the country very soon. So it's inevitable. We have to be dealing with floods, and we have to be dealing with how to respond to these water intrusion events. Some are natural causes, natural disasters, floods, heavy rains, and, for example, in Japan, tsunamis. Of course, this is a devastating water intrusion. But there are other examples of water intrusion that are, well, dealing with indoor accidentals, as I tend to call them, water leaks from pipes that are leaking, or sewage coming up through the toilets and other areas in the hospital that may have an overflow of sinks. Another example might be if people discard microfiber disposable cloths into toilets. Eventually, these items cause a backup, and next thing you know, you have a water problem in your facility. I do want to point out that if you go to the Weber archives for some of the teleclasses in the past, we did have a teleclass. I don't remember the presenter's name at the moment, but it was a colleague who had discussed what the Galveston Island area had done in response to Hurricane Ike. And as I recall, her presentation had a number of just spectacular photographs that show the devastation of that area. So water is our friend, but it can also be a very, very nasty enemy. Let's see, in slide number 7, we have some basic facts about mold. As you know, molds are ubiquitous. They are basically in many of the phyla of molds are spore-forming organisms. There are over 100,000 species of fungi, whereas a very small percentage of those are pathogenic for man. In many instances, you will see these multicellular organisms growing on any organic substance, both out in the outdoor world and inside in the indoor environment. And there are two main criteria that govern where molds tend to proliferate. The main thing is moisture and the presence of oxygen. These two are the important factors for mold growth on a substrate. Now, what you see, and you'll see this in some subsequent slides, what you'll see is molds tend to grow on porous materials more so than the hard, non-porous materials, although you do see some mold on the non-porous materials, but they do love the porous items, such as wood, paper, carpet, food, anything with cellulose, and even paint. We have a number of paints in our modern times where the paint formula has an antifungal component built into the formula to help control the presence and the proliferation of mold and mildew. In slide number 8, just an example very briefly of three very common molds that we find potentially in the indoor environment. As you know, Aspergillus is clearly a fungal agent that can pose a very, very severe problem for persons who are immunocompromised, especially those who are undergoing bone marrow transplant, necessitating use of the protective environment to control and hopefully prevent the intrusion of Aspergillus spores into their patient rooms while their recovery is underway. But Cladosporium, Penicillium, Fusarium, these are all molds that we do occasionally encounter in the indoor environment. I should say that the spores of these agents are the component of the organism that we encountered in the air almost in any room or any environment you go into. These spores are generally in the breathable range where they are less than 5 micrometers, 0.5 micrometers in diameter, and they are typically small enough to remain suspended in the air in indefinite time periods. So these are certainly can be an airborne organism if you are susceptible to these agents, and this is why the protective environment is important to protect patients who are severely immunocompromised. In slide number 9, again to reiterate the two main factors for mold growth, the presence of oxygen as a nutrient, but also nutrients that are more, shall we say, substantive, that is, items such as cellulose and other organic-type materials can be used by molds, and they break them down as they metabolize. And they do this in the presence of moisture. So this means that when we're dealing with the built environment, our buildings, our indoor spaces, we have issues with mold, especially when moisture is present indoors and it is difficult to control that moisture. Sometimes in certain climates we have problems controlling the humidity, and there is also perhaps sometimes problems with the adequacy of the ventilation. Again, if the built environment is not structurally sound, you can have roof leaks, gutters that are directing water into or under the buildings, affecting the foundation, and sometimes the landscaping, such as trees and shrubs that are too close to the building, causing intensive water damage, leading to wood rot and other things. So management of moisture is our primary objective in this whole scenario. One thing we use as a working rule of thumb is that you can expect mold growth, anticipate mold growth, when porous building materials primarily remain wet or are subjected to excessive moisture for longer than 48 to 72 hours. Anytime after that point, it's probably a given that you will encounter mold growth. But in that range of 48 to 72, depending upon ambient temperature, the continued presence of high humidity and moisture, porous materials, you could have mold growth starting much earlier, say like at 48 hours. So it's a time period where you have to be on alert to recognize the telltale signs of mold growth in the built environment. Now, for the most part, what I will do for the rest of the lecture is share with you some some information that comes from a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency document, which I found to be very, very clearly written and suitable for almost any building, any occupied space, whether it's schools, offices, hospitals, and the like. There are a few extra considerations that hospitals will need to consider, especially when it comes to what to do with medical devices and equipment. Obviously, these things are not encountered in schools and office buildings. But on slide number 10, I give you basically the cover page of this particular document. And at the end of the lecture, I'll have the website, the link to the page where you can obtain this document and keep it for reference. Again, it's fairly comprehensive. It is relatively short. It packs a lot of information into that document, which I think you will find very, very helpful should you need to respond to a water intrusion event and the need to manage and remove the mold. In slide number 11, we will start off with some things which are prevention type steps. In other words, these are things you should do in advance of any kind of water intrusion. At this point, we're dealing with prevention rather than response. And as you see here, there are about four main things that need to be done in a prevention mode. First of all, you need to be mindful and aware of any water leaks in the building, such as from the roof or the plumbing, backflow on toilets and the sewage system, breaks in water pipes, and so forth. Be aware of these events in the indoor environment as they just get worse if they are left unattended. One of the things that is always a problem when dealing with a roof leak is to understand that while water, when it is dripping from a higher point to a lower point, will drip straight down, but that does not necessarily mean where you will see the leak on the underside, the inside part of a roof or a ceiling. Water can travel horizontally on structures within the space between ceilings and roofs and between floors, and can travel horizontally to other locations. So just because a spot appears in one location on a ceiling doesn't necessarily mean that the leak is directly above that spot in a roof. So you have to get your engineer or your environmental service director to take a look up in that inter-ceiling, inter-floor space and find out where the water is coming into that area. It's important to keep the indoor humidity fairly low in the range, certainly within 30 to 50%. Any indoor relative humidity that is exceeding 60% is more conducive to mold growth than humidities that are kept in the lower range. Now, I know for some climates, such as in the desert southwest of the U.S., even keeping humidities in the range of 30 to 50% can be a problem. So it depends on the performance of your heating and ventilation system to help keep that indoor humidity range as close to that normal middle range as possible. And speaking of an HVAC system, it's important to ensure its maintenance as well, because drip pans will sometimes overflow and they will cause leaks on the ceilings. Again, you have to establish where the leak is occurring and provide maintenance to correct the problem. One thing you need to be aware of is there's condensation problems throughout a hospital. You find them sometimes in the laundry, in the central sterile department, the kitchen, and any areas where pipes or pipe cases are poorly insulated, and also the boilers. We had an outbreak investigation a few years ago that was very, very interesting. It was an ambulatory surgical center in a fairly warm, humid climate in the southern United States. And it turns out the building was not originally designed for an ambulatory surgical center. They retrofitted it to accommodate several operating rooms. But it also turned out that on the other side of the common wall of those operating rooms, in other words, there was a room on the back side of the operating room, and the wall that was common to those two areas was not very well insulated. And it turns out they were trying to keep the temperature in the operating rooms fairly consistent at 65 degrees or thereabouts. But what was on the other side of the wall was the boiler. And the boiler, as you might guess, high temperatures in a warm climate, and next thing you know, condensation routinely appeared on the surgical suite side of the wall, and it was a problem that they had very difficult time trying to manage. Anyway, in slide number 12, here's some pictures to show that it may not be easy to spot mold in the built environment in the indoor areas. Sometimes mold may be hidden by items that are placed in the room on the floors, in other words, obscuring your direct visual assessment of all spaces in a room, such as in this case a closet. Mold appearing on the wallpaper and the wallboard gradually required that those porous materials be taken out and replaced. Now, how do you have some indirect signs to tell you if mold is present in your indoor environment? In slide number 13, I just give you two things that can help clue you in when mold is possibly actively present in your area. First of all, molds give off volatile organic compounds, and they are very distinctive in their odors. You can easily tell when mold and mildew are present in an area. Another tool that you have available is through particle counting. Again, since fungal spores are generally approximately 0.5 micrometers or less in diameter, you can set a particle counter to pick up particles of that diameter in a range centered on that value. What you do is you take particle counts from the outdoor air and get a value for that reading. And then you come into the building in the area where you suspect there is a fungal burst taking place, and you take a particle reading there in that particular space. Next thing you must do is make a note of the percentage filtration designated for that area. In general, many areas in the what I'll call the non-surgical suite area is generally 90% filtration on the second bank of filters. So let's give you an example. When you compare the indoor count to what is found outdoors, taking into account the filtration, you can get a feel for whether there is a bloom of fungal spores in the area. And as an example, let's say you got a reading of 50,000 particles in the outdoor air per unit volume that you sampled. And you go in and you go to your room, and let's say the room has 90% filtration for that room. And you take a particle reading and you find that it is a little bit less than 5,000 particles, again, for an equivalent volume. In this case, your filtration is 90%. The particles remaining in that room are less than 5,000, which is certainly a little bit less than 10% remaining in the room. So in this case, you do not have a burst of fungal particles in that room per se. But let's say in the example, again, you have a 50,000 particle count from outdoor air, and you come in and measure the particle count in the room, and you find you have 10,000 particles in that room, again, for the equivalent measurement compared to the outdoor air. This would suggest that there's more particles in that space than are removed by the filtration. In other words, you have probably maybe a 20% presence of particles as opposed to just the 10%. Again, if your filtration percentage is supposed to be 90%, but you're seeing double the amount that you would normally expect, you probably have fungal particles that are floating in your area. In slide number 14, again, getting back to the hospital there in the Mississippi area after Katrina, this is one of the slides where they are about to begin the process of remediation, and you can see they're not quite ready to get that fully engaged, and the main reason is because there's still some standing water on the floor. You can see from the reflection of the bag support there in the middle of the room, but they do have some preliminary work to do before they can undertake a full remediation. Now, in slide number 15, here we are now beginning the discussion of what you need to consider when you're about to undertake a mold removal and mold structure remediation activity for your facility. Some of these projects can be quite huge, especially a natural disaster such as a flood or a tsunami will be much more involved and extensive compared to fixing a roof leak or a burst pipe. And in many instances, it's important to designate someone who can be the supervisor of the whole project. In some instances, it might be necessary to call in a professional company to help with the remediation after you assess the damage, the extent of the damage, and determine the need for removal and repair or cleaning is involved. When you determine the source of the water intrusion, if it is a leak, you need to make the repair. If it is a natural disaster, hopefully the standing water phase of that disaster is abated, and there is a way to remove the standing water from the facility to start the process of starting to clean up and dry out the facility. In slide number 16, these are the first few steps of the remediation process. Your first goal, as I mentioned, is to remove the freestanding water. You can't do anything beyond that if standing water is still present. You'll need to assess the extent of the water damage. How far up do you see a water line mark on the walls? You'll need to call in your engineer for your facility to determine what structures lie beneath the tile, the carpeting, the surface flooring. In other words, the underfloor, is it wood, is it cement slab, what is the material underneath? You need to understand what materials might be in the interwall spaces, and if the flooding or the standing water has actually been greater than one story or more, you need to assess what is happening between the ceiling and the floors in that interspace between the floors. In some instances, the HVAC system may also be affected, and you'll be relying on that to help with the drying out of the structures in your facility. So, in essence, some of these elements, such as filters and ductwork, need to be assessed for any kind of damage or the presence of dampness and damp filters. That will be one of the first things you repair are the porous materials in the ductwork in the HVAC system. So again, you will have a a source of dry air moving through the facility. And when you're dealing with structural materials, it's helpful to have tools that are capable of measuring the residual moisture in these materials, such as moisture meters, which you can press against things such as drywall or wood, and their contacts are designed to equilibrate to a reading which shows up on a screen as a percentage of moisture. A boroscope is a device that will enable you to assess moisture, say, in interwall spaces, and is a useful tool for your engineers to assess the extent of the damage between the walls. Now, many of these tasks will involve personal protective equipment. Now, for the most part, and I'll run through a number of tables from the EPA document very quickly in this regard. For dealing with clean water, water intrusion events, such as a pipe leak or a roof leak, per se, those will probably need some determination on the extent of personal protective equipment involved. And as you'll see in another slide immediately following, there are three levels for determining personal protective equipment requirements. Whenever you are dealing with what we call contaminated water, such as sewage, or if the water has potentially hazardous chemicals or biological pollutants, then at least in the United States, personal protective equipment is required. This is probably a good recommendation for other countries when personnel are doing remediation to also employ personal protective equipment for whenever a hazardous water source is involved. Now, one thing is true, it's a judgment call sometimes on what is actually needed for personal protective equipment, but generally the level of protection is determined by the total surface area of your space that is contaminated. If you have a very large space, where, such as the hospitals in the Gulf Coast, where virtually everything became wet and in many instances became a good substrate for mold growth, you will probably be going with maybe a full level of personal protective equipment. For a water leak, where mold growth is started but is not extensive, minimum personal protective equipment may be required. And in slide, let's see, number 18, these are the items that are considered appropriate for the different levels of personal protective equipment. Definitely gloves, sometimes a full body covering, or perhaps just coveralls and goggles, eye protection, in some instances, N95 respirators. Again, it's a judgment call on what is needed, but you can be guided by the extent of the project in helping to determine what personal protection is necessary. And one of the things that I wanted to point out very briefly, in slide number 19, which is another photograph, you can see in this, again, another photograph from the hospital in the Mississippi area. You can see the extent of the water damage up on the wooden pallet there to the right, cardboard box literally will have to be thrown out. But also the item of equipment that comes into play. Whenever you have equipment that has been underwater or a medical device per se that has been affected by water intrusion, in this instance, it is probably best to consider having the equipment sent back to the manufacturer for professional clean out and to determine if the equipment is still salvageable. With devices, in some instances, especially some of the surgical instruments that are relatively easy to clean. They can be thoroughly cleaned if needed, disassembled as you normally would do if it's necessary for the proper reprocessing of the medical device, to thoroughly clean those items up, and then take them to a source for sterilizing them as per usual. You can do it in a facility affected by water if your engineers have determined that the boilers for your sterilizers are back running correctly, the sterilizing equipment is operational, and you have a clean source of water for the cleaning and reprocessing of the instruments. If that is not happening in your facility at that point in time, then you need to take the instruments to another location for them to be cleaned up and reprocessed for you. In slide number 20, keep or toss? And this is an interesting question. Well, do you or not? Basically, keep in mind the rule of thumb that if you have an item affected by standing water or moisture, the item should be thoroughly dried out within 48 to 72 hours. If you see mold growth already visible, or if the item is still wet after that time, it is probably a wise idea to just toss and especially remove it if the item is building material. You're looking for moisture meter readings that should be less than 20% of the porous building materials. And in the little photo there to the right, the moisture meter is being used to assess the residual moisture content of the subflooring, which in this case is plywood. Now, I do want to share with you very quickly and recommend that you do go to this EPA document and have it on hand, simply because table number one, which I did not include in the lecture here today, is, I think, an important guide for helping to determine if items that have suffered clean water damage can be salvaged. And these would be ones that could potentially be dried out in less than a day, certainly not much later than 2 days, and this might include books or papers, carpeting and the backing of the carpeting, some ceiling tiles, concrete or cinder blocks, hard surfaces, upholstered furniture, wood, drapes, things of that nature. One of the things that is very important, again, you do really need to get rid of the standing water first. You do need to have a source of clean water in the area. You do not want to be operating fans in the area, especially if there is standing water. You do want to make sure that the HVAC system in your facility has been repaired, assessed and repaired as needed. In some instances, if you are dealing with books and papers, if these are not valuable items, you can toss them. If they are valuable, it's important to perhaps make a copy and determine if you can dry the item out effectively as quickly as possible. If that is not very practical, you may end up needing to discard the original. With carpeting, you may need to take that up and allow the understructure, the floor, to thoroughly dry out. Also dry the carpeting out. You can do this through a vacuum that is a water-extracting vacuum. Make sure that the humidity in the area is reduced again. If needed, use a dehumidifier. And fans can help accelerate the drying process for the carpeting. Upholstered furniture and wood, the sooner you can remove these items to an area where they can be cleaned up and assessed for whether you can save them or not is best. With wood, you really do want to get them away from moisture as soon as possible, and then with gentle heat and fans, try to dry these items out as much as possible. Table 1 is a very useful table to help you determine for the smaller materials whether you can keep them or not. So go to the EPA document for that type of information. Now, when it comes to determining, okay, what do I do? With mold, should I disinfect it or should I get rid of it? What's the best course of action? In slide number 21, here are some rules of thumb related to that question. In essence, the main goal for dealing with mold in a building is you need to get rid of it. You cannot rely on merely disinfecting surfaces in a building and say that that's going to be the end of your problem, because the disinfection step is more of an inactivation as opposed to removal. With disinfected or inactivated mold, you still have the mold structures there, and inactivated mold can be potentially allergenic and in some instances also be toxic to occupants in a space. So the rule of thumb is you remove visible mold and you clean surfaces that may have been in a water intrusion event but are not showing visible mold just yet, or if there is visible mold, it is minimal. If you see extensive visible mold, the underlying structure has got to go. When it comes down to a decision, if you do want to disinfect, say for example, a hard non-porous surface in the area, you should know that bleach is not the only chemical option that you have available to you. At least in the U.S., U.S. EPA, as you know, has a registration program for antimicrobial chemicals. And in some instances, when you look at the labels of a number of products, you will find that some products are registered for the purpose of mold and mildew disinfection, and that's pretty nearly the only information that the manufacturer has supplied to the agency for review, and is for that purpose what these products are registered for. So you'll find a number of products that can be used effectively for disinfection of hard non-porous surfaces in a mold intrusion area. And all I can say is check your environmental agency in your country and see what their recommendations and requirements are for the use of chemicals in a remediation process. Now, on slide 22, I have, actually it's 22, 23, and 24, are reprinting Table 2 in the EPA document. And this talks about what you will do in terms of dealing with personal protective equipment, a large-scale containment activity and or a cleaning method whenever you are dealing with a water intrusion event caused by clean water. And it is with the clean water events that there are a number of decisions that have to be made. Whereas with a contaminated water event, perhaps one with sewage or ones with hazardous chemicals, the decision-making process is a little bit simplified. You do extensive pre-PE, you do containment, and you do everything to the max, and the EPA document will go into more detail about that. But on a daily basis, we might encounter clean water intrusions more than we do the catastrophic events. So in this particular table, this part of Table 2 in slide 22, this is when you have a small area that is affected, such as you see stains and or water evidence of water damage that is less than 10 square feet in area. You can see a number of the items, and I apologize if the image is a little fuzzy, But a number of the items you might encounter in that space and the cleaning method appropriate for each one of those items. Below the table, the cleaning methods include wet vacuuming, damp wiping with cleaning chemicals, HEPA vacuum after the materials have dried are the main cleaning methods for a small area. With PPE, if you go back to the earlier slide, such a small affected area, the amount of PPE required is minimal, and the suggested items are listed there in that column. You would not normally have a containment operation for a small area because the degree of contamination from mold is expected to be fairly low. And slide number 23, this is a part of the table dealing with a medium affected area, again with a clean water intrusion, where the total surface area affected is between 10 and 100 square feet. And you can see that now we have introduced into the cleaning methods, or I'll say the remediation methods, in addition to the three that we mentioned earlier, you now have the option of the discarding of the items, including some of the porous building materials. And when the cleanup area is becoming larger than something immediately manageable, less than 10 square feet, then you may need the help of a professional cleanup crew to help with the decision-making on what degree of personal protective equipment is needed, as well as if containment is needed. With the available cleaning methods that you see for the materials listed there in the left-hand column, the removal item or discard, number four, is typically looked at for some of the building materials such as the drywall and upholstered furniture, especially fairly large upholstered pieces of furniture that perhaps have been in standing water for some time. And slide number 24, which is the last part of table two, when you have a large area affected, greater than 100 square feet, this is certainly going to require an evacuation of personnel, probably from the building, definitely from the immediate area. But you can see that now you have moved from this gray area, do I do limited or minimal PPE? It's just evident that the scope of this type of a project requires full PPE. You need to have professional judgment brought in for these very large scale events, and certainly with containment, you will more than likely need to cordon off the area while the remediation is underway, primarily because you will more than likely be taking out a large degree of the porous building materials affected by mold, especially if they cannot be dried out within the 48-72-hour rule. And in slide number 25, here are some more details of the different methods that are involved in cleanup and remediation. If you have some degree of moisture on materials, maybe such as carpeting and so forth, if you can thoroughly dry them out and remove minimal standing water with a wet vacuum, you may be able to just clean the item and go forward from there. But again, if visible mold growth is present, it's probably prudent to remove the item. When you are taking materials out, whether they're handheld items that are porous, such as books or paper, or water-damaged building materials, it is probably a very good idea to first put them in plastic bags and eventually to discard them normally as routine solid waste, but you need to check with your jurisdiction to determine what the proper waste disposal recommendations would be. And wherever you have areas that have been cleaned up and dried up, the final step will be HEPA vacuuming the area after the materials and the structures are dried. With containment, if you are needing containment for the area while a remediation project is underway, you can have either a limited form of containment with polyester or polyethylene sheeting, using a HEPA fan filtered unit to induce a negative pressure into the area, and then manage the HVAC system as needed to block the supply and the return air vents in the area so that disturbed mold spores do not go all the way through your facility to other areas that are not affected. Whereas full containment certainly is definitely has a more intensive degree of cordoning off the area, perhaps even having an airlock or an anti-room type chamber, and again, maintaining negative pressure and blocking the airflow to and from the area, again, to prevent mold spores from traveling throughout the facility. Now, the question has come up, and this is in slide number 27, should you do environmental sampling in response to a mold remediation project? And the answer to that is generally no. In many instances, mold growth being a very visible thing, you can do a visual assessment is certainly sufficient. If you do sampling, and by this we're saying now microbiologic sampling, it should be done with a defined purpose and a stated objective. You can be doing air sampling, sampling of water, surfaces, or dust. It depends on, again, the purpose of the sampling. Typically, if microbiologic sampling is done, you'll find that air sampling is probably the method and the step that is done most frequently. But it's important to recognize that we, at this point, still do not have established benchmarks for either the acceptable number of spores in an airspace, in an area, and so if we have nothing fixed to compare our readings to, it makes the interpretation a little bit difficult to do with certainty. Nevertheless, some people do some sampling to confirm in their mind that at least the numbers are low. So how do you know when you're finished? And again, if we do not do environmental sampling, are there some other methods to help you determine the job is done? Well, first thing, that the source of moisture or water intrusion is fixed and removed. There is no standing water. Everything is cleaned up. Visible mold is no longer present. There are no more mold-damaged materials. You should not be detecting mold or mildew odors in the area. If the sampling of the air is done, especially for particles, keeping filtration in mind, you should have established a rank order analysis reflecting that the filtration in the area is doing its job. Mold growth does not occur, and the occupants of the space are reporting no health complaints or sense of volatile organic compounds in the air. And in the end, it's kind of a judgment call. If your engineer, your industrial hygienist, your environmental services colleagues, if they sense that they have met these criteria to their satisfaction, there's a good chance you're all done. So for the remaining slides, slide 29 just gives you the resources that EPA used to prepare the materials in Table 2. So those are the source data, the source documents for that information. In slide 30, I've given you the internet sites where you can obtain more information involving both the document we were referring to today, as well as NIOSH, which is the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. It's a subunit within CDC, have always provided occupational concerns for workers when doing mold cleanup or dealing with hazards associated with disaster cleanup. With CDC, there is an MMWR, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, also a mold prevention strategies and health effects for the aftermath of hurricanes and major floodings. And occasionally you will see publications from professional groups who specialize in remediation and professional restoration. And this one particular document has been cited quite frequently among folks who are professionals in the industry. And so, slide 31, I just want to acknowledge the source of some of the photos for the hospital there in the Mississippi area, Dr. Deborah Levy, who's a colleague of mine in DHQP. And as I mentioned, the EPA is a very excellent resource for management of mold remediation projects and a good source for you to check out when you have some free time. So with that, I would like to say thank you very much for your time and attention. Hopefully this was useful to you. We will all encounter water in our lives at some point. So having this document available for referral, I think, is an excellent thing for us all to do. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for letting me have this hour with you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Seeholster. That was a very, very informative presentation. And thank you for the references at the end. I think the vast majority of people need to have these documents saved somewhere on their hard drive, ready to get to when the flood happens. I think from my experience, most of us will experience a flood, so it's not the if, it's definitely the when. Do you know, I just want to ask you a quick question with the time we have left, is the EPA looking at updating the document?
I believe they have said they're doing a review of documents as on what I'll call a established schedule where periodically documents of a certain vintage are up for review and so forth. Now, I haven't heard specifically about this one, but from EPA's point of view, its cover date is March 2001. It's probably considered still fairly relevant, and if there is a revision, it is probably going to be minor in scope.
To know. You also referred to the presentation from Weber Teleclasses on the infection control response to Hurricane Ike, and I did have a chance to flip back. That was done by Pam Falk back on December 3rd, 2009, and it is in the archive library if the listeners wanted to go back to that. Again,
it's
with the time we've got left.
Presentation.
Yes, as was yours, and I'd like to thank you very much again for the time you've spent with us here, and I'd like to thank the CDC for sponsoring you through the Division of National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. With the last minute that we have left, again, thank you very much, Dr. Seeholster, for putting this together and giving us the presentation. I'd like to thank the participants that have listened in. If any of them do have a question that they'd like to send along, you can do that through the Weber Training website. There is a link saying Contact Us. And if you send a question in through that, I know Paul will make sure that Dr. Seeholster gets that. So once again, thank you very much, and we look forward to future teleclasses.